Okay, let's unpack this. We're taking a deep dive into your sources, the material you shared, which opens up the absolutely fascinating world of brain networks.
It really is fascinating. Think of it like this. Your brain isn't just a collection of separate parts doing their own thing. It's more like a huge dynamic community.
A community. I like that.
Yeah, where different regions are constantly talking, coordinating, collaborating to make everything happen. That's sort of the core idea behind these brain networks.
Exactly. And your sources really stress this. It's less about where something happens and much more about how different areas team up.
That's the key takeaway.
So our mission today, to pull out the most important nuggets from this material. We want to help you really grasp the concept, understand the main ways researchers look at these networks, and then meet some of the big players, the well-known networks, what they do, and why they matter.
Right. And hopefully you'll have some genuine aha moments. It's all based directly on the information you provided, looking at this incredible system inside your head.
So diving straight in, what exactly are these brain networks? Your sources define them as collections of interconnected brain regions working together on specific functions. But what really jumps out is that it's not just about physical location, is it?
No, that's a crucial point your sources make. Anatomy matters, of course, but networks are often defined by functional connectivity.
Functional connectivity meaning?
Meaning how regions sync up their activity, how they talk to each other, exchange information, even if they're physically far apart in the brain. Think of them like project teams.
Okay, specialized teams.
Yeah.
And how do we even know these teams exist? How can researchers actually see this coordination happening?
Ah, well, that's where neuroimaging comes in. Techniques like fMRI, functional MRI, or EEG, they let scientists observe brain activity.
Right, looking at blood flow or electrical signals.
Exactly. And from those patterns, they can infer how different regions are interacting, how information is flowing between them. It's how they map these dynamic connections.
And why is understanding this level of organization so critical? Why look at networks instead of just single spots?
Well, your material really emphasizes this why. It gives us a much deeper understanding of just normal, healthy brain function, you know, memory, attention, language, emotion, all that.
Okay, that makes sense.
But just as importantly, it offers vital clues into what goes wrong in neurological and psychiatric disorders. When a network gets disrupted, it can highlight problems in a way that just looking at one region might miss.
Okay, so networks are these collaborating regions defined largely by how they connect and talk. Now, your sources highlight that to really understand them, we need to look at them from different angles. They point to four crucial aspects. This feels like a really key part of getting the bigger picture from your material.
Absolutely. It's not a simple picture. These aspects give us different lenses to view the complexity.
First up, something we just touched on, functional connectivity.
Right. So this is all about the how they talk aspect, how brain regions synchronize their activity, their firing patterns, even if they aren't right next to each other.
And that's measured by looking for those correlated patterns in fMRI or EEG data.
Precisely. If two regions consistently light up together, functionally speaking, they're likely part of a network, even if physically distant.
And why is tracking that synchronization so important?
Your sources emphasize it's vital because it shows how the brain integrates information across different areas and coordinates really complex tasks. And significantly, changes or disruptions in this functional connectivity are often linked to various disorders. It's like the team isn't communicating effectively anymore.
Got it. Functional connectivity is the coordinated activity, the conversation. What about the physical side? The structure.
Yeah, that brings us right to the second aspect, structural connectivity. This is the brain's underlying physical infrastructure.
The wiring diagram.
That's a perfect analogy, yeah. It maps the actual nerve pathways, the axons, the white matter tracks that physically connect different regions. It's the roads the information travels on.
So functional is the traffic, structural is the roads.
Exactly. Structural connectivity provides the necessary foundation, the pathways for information to flow. Your material mentions techniques like diffusion tensor imaging, DTI, which lets researchers map these physical tracks.
And I assume problems with the roads cause problems with the traffic.
Definitely. The sources note that abnormalities in this physical wiring, breaks, or inefficiencies in the structure can lead to significant cognitive or motor function issues.
Okay, so we have the conversation, functional, and the roads, structural. What's the third lens your sources mention?
That would be network topology. This uses ideas from graph theory, basically network science, to analyze the organization of the whole system.
Graph theory, like nodes and edges.
Exactly. It's about mapping how regions are connected, how dense the connections are, and identifying key hubs.
Hubs, like major train stations.
Yeah, precisely. Regions that are highly connected, acting as central points for information flow. Your sources explain that analyzing this topology reveals things about the network's efficiency and its resilience, how well it can handle disruptions. Certain patterns are linked to adaptability or robustness.
Interesting. Okay, and the fourth aspect, you mentioned these networks aren't static.
Not at all. And this is a really crucial point your sources highlight, dynamic networks. The brain is incredibly flexible. Network connections and activity patterns aren't set in stone. They change constantly.
Constantly, like second to second.
Yes, on very rapid timescales, but also depending on your mental state, are you resting, focused, asleep, and over longer periods too, like development, learning, or aging.
So the way these teams talk and even which roads get used can shift depending on what you're doing or thinking at that moment.
That's the idea. Understanding these dynamics, both the quick changes and the long-term shifts, is essential. It underlies flexible processes like learning new things, adapting to situations, maybe even consciousness itself. Your material also notes it helps understand how networks might try to reorganize after, say, a brain injury.
Okay, those four aspects, functional connectivity, structural connectivity, topology, and dynamics, they really give us a solid framework for how to think about brain networks based on your sources. So now, shall we meet some of the actual teams, the well-known networks?
Let's do it. There are several key networks researchers have identified, each linked to specific kinds of functions, and seeing them really brings these concepts together.
Right. And the first one that gets a lot of airtime and is prominent in your material is the default mode network, the DMN.
Ah, yes, the DMN. What's so interesting about it, maybe a bit counterintuitive, is that this network is most active when you're not focused on the outside world.
When you're zoning out.
Pretty much. Think daydreaming, mind wandering, reflecting on yourself, remembering things from your past, thinking about the future.
So it's not really off when we're resting. It's just doing different stuff, internal stuff.
Exactly. It's a very active default state. Your sources mention key regions like the medial prefrontal cortex, posterior cingulate cortex, the precuneus. But the names aren't as important as what they do together.
Okay, so what are its main jobs, according to the sources?
Things like self-referential processing, that sort of inner monologue or sense of self, emotional regulation, especially related to personal memories and experiences, theory of mind, understanding that other people have thoughts and feelings, mind wandering, which sounds passive but is linked to creativity and planning, and memory consolidation, kind of making sense of experiences.
Wow. Okay. So it's deeply involved in our internal world, our sense of self, and how we relate to others.
Hmm.
It's fascinating that it ramps down when we focus externally.
It is. And your sources note its activity is often inversely correlated with networks that handle focused external tasks. When you need to concentrate hard, the DMN usually quiets down.
And when that balance gets messed up.
That's where the links to disorders come in. Your material mentions that dysfunction in the DMN or its interactions with other networks is implicated in conditions like Alzheimer's disease, depression, and schizophrenia.
Now, here's where your sources bring in something really intriguing, connecting back to that idea of network dynamics, psychedelics, and the DMN.
Yes, this section discusses research looking at how certain substances, like psilocybin from mushrooms or LSD, seem to alter DMN activity quite dramatically.
And these changes correlate with the kinds of experiences people report.
That's what the research suggests. For example, the material points to studies finding reduced DMN activity, particularly a breakdown in its usual coherence.
Less organized.
Kinda, yeah. And this reduction seems to correlate with subjective reports of ego dissolution or a blurring of the sense of self.
Okay, what else?
Alongside that, some studies report increased global connectivity. It's like the usual boundaries between different networks become more fluid, more interconnected. And this might relate to feelings of expanded awareness or oneness people sometimes describe.
And there were mentions of brainwave changes, too. Reduced alpha waves, maybe more delta or gamma.
Yes, those kinds of changes in electrical activity have also been observed in some studies now. It is absolutely crucial, and your sources are very clear about this in a words of caution section.
Right, the caveats. Super important here.
Extremely. We need to be crystal clear. We're reporting what the research in your sources indicates, not making definitive claims or endorsements. First off, correlation isn't causation.
Meaning, just because DMN changes happened at the same time as ego dissolution doesn't automatically mean the DMN change caused it?
Precisely. There could be other factors, or it could be more complex. Also, the whole idea of enlightenment or mystical experience is inherently subjective and complex. Whether drug-induced states truly equate to that is, well, it's debated.
And people react very differently, don't they?
Massively. The sources stress huge individual differences. Your mindset, the setting, the dose, your personal psychology, it all plays a huge role. Experiences aren't universally positive.
Definitely not. And the long-term effects.
That's the final big caveat from your material. Much more research is needed on the long-term effects. This is an active, evolving area of study, not settled science.
Okay, very important context there. So moving on from the DMN and our internal world, what about the network that kicks in when we do need to focus externally and get stuff done?
Right, that brings us to the central executive network, the CEN. Sometimes it's called the frontoparietal network, if the DMN is about internal processing and mind wandering.
The CEN is the get down to business network.
Exactly. It's the command center for effortful, goal-directed tasks. It becomes active when you need to concentrate and manage information.
So what kinds of functions are we talking about?
Your sources link it to key higher order cognitive functions. Things like working memory, holding information online, like a phone number. Attentional control, focusing your spotlight. Decision-making, planning complex actions, cognitive flexibility, shifting between different tasks smoothly, and inhibitory control, stopping yourself from getting distracted.
Sounds crucial for, well, most of daily life. What parts of the brain are key players here?
Key regions mentioned include the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, sort of the front part of the brain behind your forehead, and the posterior parietal cortex further back. They work together closely to manage these demanding tasks.
And like the DMN, problems here are linked to certain conditions.
Yes. The material notes that dysfunction in the CEN is associated with disorders like ADHD, where attention and executive control can be challenging, as well as schizophrenia and consequences of traumatic brain injury.
Okay, next up in your sources is the salience network, or SN. It's described as the vigilant sentinel. I like that image.
It's a great description because its core job really is to monitor everything, both your internal state and what's happening outside, to detect what's important or salient.
So it's constantly scanning, is this worth paying attention to?
Pretty much. And critically, it acts as a kind of dynamic switch operator between the DMN and the CEN.
So it helps manage that balance we talked about.
Exactly. Your sources describe it this way. When the salience network detects something significant, maybe a sudden noise or an internal feeling like hunger, or even just something relevant to your current goal, it signals the CEN to ramp up.
To deal with it.
Right. And it signals the DMN to quiet down so you're not lost in thought when you need to act or focus externally.
That's a really critical role. Which brain areas are central to this network?
Two key regions highlighted are the anterior insula, which is deep inside the brain and involved in awareness of internal bodily sensations and emotions, and the dorsal anterior cingulate cortex, or DACC, which is involved in monitoring for conflict and errors. They work together, integrating sensory input with emotional and cognitive information to flag what's important.
And its influence goes beyond just switching attention.
Oh, yes. Your material points to its role in emotional regulation, social cognition, like picking up on subtle social cues that are salient, and even pain perception. And again, dysfunction is implicated in conditions like ADHD, anxiety disorders, and schizophrenia, where this process of filtering, prioritizing, and switching might be impaired.
The sources also discuss the attention network, but they clarify it's not just one thing, right? It's actually two networks.
That's right, because attention itself is multifaceted. You've got the dorsal attention network, or DAN. Think of this as your top-down voluntary attention system.
Top-down meaning I decide what to focus on.
Exactly. It's goal-directed. When you deliberately focus on reading the sentence, or keep your eyes on the road while driving, or scan a crowd for a friend that's your Dan at work, sustained attention, spatial attention, choosing where to direct focus.
Okay, so that's the Dan. What's the other one?
That's the ventral attention network, or VAN. This is more bottom-up, driven by stimuli in the environment.
Bottom up, so things grabbing my attention.
Precisely. It's triggered by unexpected or salient events, a car horn, your name being called, a flash of movement. It acts like a circuit breaker, interrupting your current focus, managed by the DAN, to reorient you to something potentially important that just popped up.
So the DAN is me choosing where to look, and the VAN is something catching my eye.
That's a good way to put it. And critically, they interact dynamically. You need both. The ability to focus intentionally, Dan, and the ability to react to unexpected but important things, them. Your sources note that dysregulation and the interplay between these two is linked to conditions like ADHD and spatial neglect after stroke.
We also see the limbic network discussed in your material. This is often what people mean when they talk about the emotional brain.
Right. Though it's a bit more complex than just emotions. It involves several interconnected structures, many of which are pretty well known. There's the amygdala.
Often linked to fear.
Right. Crucial for processing emotions, especially fear, and tagging memories with emotional significance. Then there's the hippocampus, vital for forming new long-term memories and also for spatial navigation. The thalamus acts like a central relay station, filtering most sensory information before it goes to the cortex. And parts of the prefrontal cortex are involved in regulating emotional responses.
So how do these work together as a network?
Fundamentally, this network is about processing and regulating our emotions, linking emotions to memories, why some memories feel so strong, and influencing our decisions based on emotional factors. It interacts heavily with networks like the DMN, our internal state, and the CEN, decision making. And as you'd expect, dysregulation is linked to anxiety disorders, depression, PTSD, but also memory disorders like Alzheimer's, given the hippocampus's role.
Okay, one more major network highlighted in your sources, the reward network. This sounds pretty fundamental to why we do, well, anything.
It absolutely is. This network is the brain's core system for processing rewarding experiences, driving motivation, and generating feelings of pleasure. It's what reinforces behaviors that are beneficial, or at least perceived as beneficial.
And what are the key components here?
Your sources mention the ventral tegmental area, or VTA, a key hub for producing dopamine, which is a crucial neurotransmitter here.
Dopamine, the pleasure chemical.
It's often called that, though it's more about motivation and reinforcement learning than just pleasure itself. That dopamine acts strongly on the nucleus accumbens, or NACHIC, which processes the rewarding effects and tells the brain that was good, do it again. The prefrontal cortex is also involved, helping to evaluate the potential rewards versus risks of an action.
So a good experience leads to dopamine release, hitting the nucleus accumbens, reinforcing that behavior.
That's the basic loop, simplified. And your material makes a key point here about addiction. Many addictive drugs essentially hijack this system.
Oh, so?
They cause huge unnatural surges of dopamine, creating a powerful reinforcement signal that overrides normal motivations and drives compulsive drug-seeking behavior. So this network is central to understanding addiction, but also other disorders related to motivation, pleasure, and reward processing.
Wow. Okay. So we've gone through the basic idea of networks, the different ways to look at them, functional, structural, topology, dynamics, and then met these specific teams, DMN, CEN, salience, attention, limbic, reward. What's the big takeaway from seeing it all laid out like this?
I think the main point your sources drive home is that understanding the brain at this network level gives us a much richer, more integrated picture. It helps us see how complex things like thoughts, feelings, and actions actually emerge from the interplay between regions.
It's not just one spot doing one thing.
Exactly. It's about how these specialized teams collaborate, sometimes compete, and dynamically coordinate their activity. It moves us beyond thinking about just isolated locations.
And it really underscores why studying changes in these networks, both within a network and in how they interact with each other, is so fundamental for understanding both healthy brain function and the complexities of brain disorders. It truly is a shift in perspective, isn't it? From location to interaction. We have covered a remarkable amount of ground in this deep dive, pulling from your sources on brain networks, from the basic concept, the wiring diagrams, the dynamic conversations between regions, to meeting the specific teams like the introspective DMN, the focused CEN, the vigilant salience network, and the networks handling our attention, emotions, and motivations.
It really is a reminder of the incredible dynamic complexity packed inside your skull. Thinking about how these networks are constantly shifting and interacting within you right now, even as you listen, it's quite something.
It is. And here's a final important question that seems to emerge from your sources, something for you to ponder. If these brain networks are so inherently dynamic and adaptable, constantly changing based on experience, state, maybe even intention, what could that fundamental potential for change mean?
What might it imply for our understanding of something as profound and fluid as consciousness itself? Or perhaps more pragmatically, for developing entirely new approaches to therapies aimed at retraining or reshaping network function in the future?
A lot to think about there. Huh? Something to mull over as you continue your own deep dive into the absolutely fascinating world of your brain.